Good morning. Yeah, I was going to say, too, that from my perspective, we're doing at least three things here. One is keeping the original languages alive, and so part of what we do is to go very intentionally at the language, kind of pick away at it a little bit, analyze this and that. And some of that a little pedantic, but it is done to keep the languages current. Another one is to be thinking homiletically. So we've got this text, so what? What is there that makes a good preachable package? What are some of the things that whoever's standing up here, what are some of the things I'd go after if I were preaching on this text? And the third thing is to think pericopally, if that's a word. We've got Old Testament and New Testament, or really actually Old Testament and Gospel here together. How do you fit these two together? Why were they put together? And what kind of a package do they make together? So a couple of three things that we kind of go after as we stand up here, or get ready to stand up here, and some days one may dominate or two, but in the overall, that's kind of what we do, and I think it's a lot of fun. We have a very short Old Testament lesson for what Sunday is it? 18th, I think, after Pentecost. Only three verses from the book of the prophet Jeremiah. Within the context of the book of Jeremiah, they form the first of a series of what are conventionally called the confessions of Jeremiah. Those instances, 11, 12, 15, 17, 18, 20, where Jeremiah really goes to God, and in some cases goes after God, because the pain of his ministry is such that it's no longer tolerable, and he goes either with lament or he goes with accusation. And the first one is the one we have here. We have only part of it, or we actually have his words. 21 to 23 has a reply of God to Jeremiah. The two form a package, and they lead directly into what is a separate one in chapter 12. But that's only a matter of context. Let's look at the Hebrew first. One thing that just jumped out at me as I was glancing at it one more time before coming in here. Look at the first word of each of the three verses. It kind of struck me. Each of them begins with a vowel consecutive. Each of them begins with a vowel consecutive followed by a noun and not a verb. Not a vowel consecutive, but a vowel. But Lord, but I, but Yahweh. You know, kind of a very clear indication of a contrast. When you look to God is one thing that's there, a matter of hope and prayer usually. You get to verse 19, but I, and you come toward lament kind of a spirit, and then in verse 20, back to prayer again. But Yahweh, or and Yahweh, ho the ani, the root yadha, to know, hifil, perfect, he made. A pronominal suffix, he made me to know, he showed me, he told me, he revealed to me, and as a consequence, I knew. The same root, which is to say, had he not made it known to me, I would not have known, the way the two are put together there. He made it known to me, and that's the only way I could possibly have known. Under that I have known, you see the athnach there, which is the comma, which means that the word then really belongs, the az belongs to the second half. Then you made me to see their doings. Alal is a 5 and 10 cent word, nickel and dime word, to do. It's not necessarily used in a bad sense of its own right. Here it happens to be that. You were the one that helped me to see what it was that they were up to. Verse 19. On my part, as a lamb, a gentle lamb, Yuval, passive participle, led along, brought along, brought by whoever, to slaughter. That's what I was. I did not know that Alai, it was concerning me or toward me, that they schemed their schemings. You have the verb and the noun, both of the same root, which is common in Hebrew and certainly in the prophets. It was against me that they were after. After the word their schemings, kind of, if we were doing it in English, we'd put a quote mark. Let us destroy, the root shachath. Let us destroy Eitz tree. And this next word is kind of a strange one, at least in the context. The word is lechem, bread. Let us destroy the tree in its bread. Septuagint handles that by saying, let's throw some wood in his bread or something. I don't know, poison him or whatever. I don't know. They don't know what to do with it either. You look at the commentaries, and one way of paraphrasing it is to say, let's destroy the tree and its sap, or with its fruit. Kind of, in both cases, an extension of the image of bread. If you look at the footnote down at the bottom, there's an alternate reading offered. Read, in all likelihood, but absolutely no manuscript evidence. Balecho, which is to say, let us destroy the tree in its freshness or in its youth. Let's cut it down prematurely. Let's get rid of him now, in other words. Possible, as I said, no textual support at all for that. Let's destroy the tree and its fruit. Let's keep it that way. And let us cut him off from the land of the living. And his name will no longer be remembered, or so that his name no longer exists, no longer is remembered, is brought to memory. But Yahweh of hosts, Shofet Tzevek, whether that should be read as, Lord, you are a just judge, shofet, as a noun, or whether this is a verbal form, you who judge righteously, and that's the way most translations, I think, give it. Yahweh of hosts, who judgest righteously, the next word here, bochein, clearly is a participle, which means that likely the first one is too. You who test or examine, scrutinize the bowels, the kidneys, and the heart. You do all of these things. I want to see. I will see. Let me see. I'd like to see your nikma, your vengeance, your retribution from them, on them. For to you, this next one is problematic also, to you I have, skip the word for a minute, whatever it is that I've done, it is my case, my situation, my problem, my circumstance, my reeve. It can be a legal word, but it can be more than just a legal word, just the situation I'm in, that I have whatever to you. The way it's pointed here, the root is gala, which is the word that is used in Hebrew for to uncover, basic meaning, to uncover. And when it's used in PL, it can mean to reveal, to uncover for someone else, to reveal, and it's used of God's revelation in the Old Testament. To you I have revealed my cause makes it sound strange, doesn't it? It's not as though God needs us to uncover anything for God. Therefore, you look at a footnote there. There have been those that have tried to improve that, again, without textual support, and so you always look at that with a little bit of suspicion. Galal, a different root. It means to roll, originally, basic meaning, to roll over, to roll on, which means to, by adapted meaning, to commit. I've given this, rolled it over to you. I've committed my cause to you, and if you look at most translations, that's exactly the way it's given. To you I have committed, not just revealed and not just made known, I have committed my cause to you. It's the same word that's used in Psalm 22, verse 8 in English, where those who are persecuting the psalmist say, let the Lord take care of him. He committed his cause to the Lord. You know, same word, same root, maybe. It's in any case the way most translations have dealt with it, and most commentaries as well. So what do we have here? We've got clearly a lament and a prayer. The prophet suddenly realizing that as loyal as he has been to Yahweh, he has not won any friends among his people. And if anything, what he has triggered is resentment and opposition to him. And when he comes to understand this, where do you go with it? What do you do with it? In Jeremiah's case, at least here, you take it to God. That's his reeve, his case, his situation, the situation he finds himself in. Reeve is an important word for the prophets generally, and certainly for Jeremiah. Sometimes he has a reeve against God. That comes in the first word in chapter 12. Not first word, first verse. I got a reeve against you, God. We got something to settle between us. Whatever it is, this case, this situation needs to be dealt with. God is the only one who can deal with it. You judge righteously. You know clearly what's in my heart and what's in my bowels, and you know them. Therefore, God, do something about it, and I'd like to see it, kind of like Jonah sitting on the side of the hill there at Nineveh. I'd like to see the fireworks, God, your retribution. Not a whole lot of gospel. Not a whole lot of gospel here, and not a whole lot of New Testament either. It makes a nice pair with what we have in the New Testament, the gospel reading, Mark chapter 9, which talks about the Son of Man being betrayed. Talks about anyone who follows the Son of Man. If he wants to be first, let him be last. Let him be the servant of all. It talks about the little ones whom the Lord treasures in the kingdom, which is to say, one strong emphasis of the day, whether prophet or Son of Man or the disciple who follows the Son of Man, one strong emphasis is that our following the Lord and our commitment to the Lord does not guarantee us anything in terms of security or in terms of acceptance or in terms of gratitude on the part of the people, even whom we serve. Reality. And this is only the first of six that Jeremiah has here in his own book. In fact, in chapter 15, verse 10, Jeremiah calls himself an Ish Reeve, a person who is just simply the focus of contention. He feels it inside, he feels it with others, he feels it with God, built into the nature of the call that God gives us. And it's a message that needs to be given not only to prospective pastors, but also to any Christian who follows the Lord. Reality check. And in that sense, it's a good lesson. Reality check. If I were going at it, another theme I would really look at hard is, to you I have committed my cause. There is an out. There is the one to whom you appeal. my reeve becomes God's reeve, right? And there is room for gospel there. Now, we certainly learn in the shadow of the cross that there's a different response to giving my reeve to God, to saying, therefore, I want to see your retribution. There was that other one who said, to you I have committed, in that case, my spirit. Shortly before that, his response, however, is to say, Father, forgive them. Jeremiah lives in the Old Testament, lives before the cross. And we take that seriously. And at the same time, we put this in juxtaposition with him who was the Son of Man to be betrayed, and so on and so on. And I think that makes for a nice blending of the two texts. Lord, you judge righteously. You test the heart and the mind. Like some of the psalmists, Jeremiah stands with a confidence before God that maybe we as Lutherans don't always find ourselves comfortable doing, kind of laying ourselves right out before God, kind of asking for God's scrutiny. And boy, you kind of wince at that a little bit, and yet even that, particularly given the juxtaposition of the New Testament reading, takes on a different meaning, doesn't it? And we who have committed our cause to him who justifies, yeah, in him the Lord can indeed and does test and scrutinize and judge. Last thing that I would look at if I were going at this text, I guess, is the strong emphasis on the word no that's here. Verse 18, Yahweh, you made me to know. That's how I got to know. And verse 19, I didn't know. Now I do know. The knowledge of God and the knowledge that God gives about what's beyond the superficial, what's beyond the phenomenological, what's beyond what the eyes see there, what's really going on out there. That is, there is an access to a knowledge that God gives. That is not there for everybody, but God does grant that to those whom he calls. I think that's it. One last thing, I guess, and it really picks up on a theme that's already been mentioned. Particularly when this passage, the rejection that comes almost built in the service of the gospel, is echoed certainly in the New Testament. Son of Man betrayed, first, last, little, big, all of that. When you deal with Christian gospel, you deal in terms of a title of a book that Paul Brecher wrote some, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, the world upside down. Beatitudes, normal value system, upside down. And it's kind of the way it is in the Lord. And the prophet knew it, and he lived with it, and he suffered under it, as did our Lord. Okay, turn it over to Jim's. Turn it over to Jim on his way. Yeah, questions.
Do you think that there's a connection, even not so much that for any man to take on suffering, we see it reflected in the cross as a lamb that's slaughtered, but especially you see the role of Jesus as the great prophet. I mean, that's a bit of the prophetic office coming through, that the prophets of old already began to experience this sort of persecution that he had. I don't know if you want, they can't hear what I just said. So.
Yeah, I think what Dr. Bartel was saying is that part of what Jesus fulfills when he is the prophet is this element of the suffering that's built into the prophetic task throughout the Old Testament, and it certainly is there because Moses knew it way back from that time. And you have the suffering servant in Isaiah, who was also like a lamb led to the slaughter, Isaiah 53, and Jeremiah, and others as well. One of the hardest lessons, it seems to me, that the prophets were called on to learn was the lesson of being satisfied with their faithfulness to God and letting some of the some of the benefits that we would like to have from a faithful task, the strokes that we get from people around us, kind of letting that go, realizing that God does not promise that to the prophets, to the Lord, or to us.
Okay, well, we can start on Mark 9.
There you are, Jim. Come right to the top. Sit at the higher table. Stand at the higher pulpit.